Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hey, everyone.
Rowan is on the deck. Say hi, Rowan.
Hi, Rowan.
Mary's in the audience. Say hi, Mary. And Micheál Martin, our Taoiseach, the leader of the country, is at the table with us, and it's a huge honour for us, as you can imagine. So thanks for taking the time.
Huge honour for me.
No, it's great.
Thank you.
I know,
for having me here.
Yeah. Like, you're the leader of our country, of 5 million people, and all the history that comes with it, and to, know, to take the time out to come talk to us for an hour is humbling for us. So huge honour. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. If people want to see you getting grilled, they can watch RT on any given day. So we're not going to do that. We just want to know, like, who is Micheál Martin? What was it like growing up? Do you know what your interests are, what your family is like, and how you kind of got into where you are today? So if we go right back, who is Micheál Martin and where did you grow up? What was the mother and father situation? And
well, Micheál Martin was born in 1960 on the 16th of August and in Turner's Cross was with a family home, 23 O'Connell Avenue, a terraced house. My mother was a Capwell woman. Her parents were East Cork. They'd come into Dunbar Street. They were in the War of Independence. Grandmother Margaret O'Hearn was a fairly active woman, you know, in the coming of man, helping people to escape from the mental hospital who were kind of, it's a long story, but some IRA prisoners would end up in the mental hospital through pretending that they had lost a soul, so to speak. She was a nurse there. She'd walk them out, Sean Moylan being one. The grandfather was in the IRA, involved in the Knocklong ambush. So they obviously came to Dunbar Street and then moved up to Capwell.
Dunbar Street is near Nanonagel.
That's right, exactly. And I still, during the lockdown, I know I kind of perfected a 5 kilometre walk, like, but I went down memory lane because cousins of mine in Lisgould, where my grandmother was from, it's said that she laid out the Clonmult boys. This was a terrible ambush where a lot of IRA volunteers were killed and a lot of nasty stuff happened after they were killed.
War of Independence.
And War of Independence time. The sister of one of them, we think now, stayed with her in Dunbar Street because she went up. Some of the bodies were brought to what is now Collins' barracks, and she went up with the sister to identify one of the lads, and she would have laid out some of them, you know. So I went down just to kind of get the sense, like, there was other cousins were in Dunbar Street, the shoemakers, the Rays. Polly. It's just kind of a special, like, I was born in Turner's Cross, so we'd walk into town, that whole area of the South Parish. You know, I walked every street of that, like, for as a child and for years growing up. So the father then was an outsider. He had a tougher upbringing than my mother, in the sense that he grew up in Clancatan. His father had come from County Meath. We don't know why. Some said it was a dispute to do with the farm up there or whatever. But unfortunately...
Where did you say he come from?
Clancatan. Not too many would know where that is. It's up by Collins's Barracks.
Okay.
St. Luke's area there. He went to St. Patrick's National School. And extraordinary family and life, because they came through a lot of difficulty and trauma early on. His father died, I think, when he was about 14 from a heart attack, and his mother died a year later. And he used to tell the story of she being in St. Finbar's, which was kind of known as the poorhouse then. And he'd call to her, and she'd say to him, like, have you tuppence for the charwoman, like, who'd bring the tea and stuff like that. So then they kind of, their older sister, Maura, she reared them. The father kind of got into the Irish Army, I'd say, at about 15. And went to Castleconnell. His two older brothers, one a stepbrother, whose father had been killed in World War I. He was out in India. But the other brother, Philip, was in Singapore. And Philip was captured at the fall of Singapore by the Japanese and was 3 years in a in a prison of war camp. And they thought he was dead. Mm. And he came out 8 stone. And the younger sister had to go to an orphanage in Cove to be reared for a couple of years. Maura looked after the younger brother, Dick, and was very anxious about my father because years later we went up to the Collins Barracks and they had all the file on them, you know, and there's loads of letters from Auntie Maura. Can you get Paddy back? His brother's coming back with malaria from India or whatever. But she held them together. And when he came out of the army, then he learned boxing in the army. He became a boxer.
Glen Boxing Club.
He joined the Glen Boxing Club. Lived in Spangle Hill with Maura and Mossy and Infirmary. And they were sort of, that was his real family growing up. And John Sheen lives in Mayfield. John would have been an athletics coach with Lee Vale and Jackie and Eileen. And Morris was passed away, unfortunately. He was a great actor with Druid Theatre Company and so on. But Paddy, really, there was a very close bond between the two families because of that sort of background, you know.
That, like, if you would think, like, it's an unbelievable amount of trauma to happen to one family, isn't it?
It is. And never really talked about, you know. Mm. And looking back, I often sort of say we should have done a bit more. Mm. And I remember my own mother saying to me, look, you are the first family that your dad really has experience of, in the sense of growing up normally or naturally or,
yeah. And is it like you've got Republican roots? So, like, and when you were growing up in that household, did you really feel that Republican presence? Are we always interested in, like, Irish history? And
I mean, there's no question. On my mother's side, I would use this. My mother, it was my mother's DNA. Like, her grandparents, were just very active in the War of Independence. My grandmother died too young, really. I was only 2 years of age. I missed that, like, because she was the matriarch. She was the political. My father would say that to me, like, that she, very strong-willed, I'd say a bit of a firebrand, you know, and took no nonsense. And in Capwell, years later, the young lads would tell me that she was she would, at that time, people were laid out in homes and so on like that. And she was the woman that would be called for to lay somebody out and so on like that. And they used to all run away then because there was a tradition and you'd throw the water that helped to clean the corpse, you'd throw that after the corpse after the hearse. And so there was all that kind of folklore around her, you know. But the father was more of a thinking sort of nationalist or Republican because he came from a background where, because they lived near Collins's barracks, there was a lot of pressure on them to go and join the British Army. There'd be a local guard that would say to him, look, you should join the army. His older brother Philip did. But he kept that quiet too, you know.
Like, it might be hard for us to imagine, like, but back in those days, Collins Barracks was occupied by the British Army.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know? That's right.
People of younger generations don't associate Collins Barracks with the soldiers that are up there today. It's one of my cousins is up there.
It was also, like, it was your route out of poverty. This was a job. Philip got into the engineering corps there. And we think that's what a lot of people say. The Japs kept the engineering corps. I mean, he wasn't a fully qualified engineer, don't get me wrong, but they needed them to build roads and bridges.
Yeah.
And so some of them survived, you know. And it's interesting, you know, politics. You know, my father was, because I don't know what, you know, in terms of his influences, and he fought hard against joining the British Army, like, as a young fella. I just find this extraordinary, the independence of mind, that he has two older brothers. One of them became a communist, Jackie. Jackie declared himself a communist. And he was a very funny guy. And Jackie would pretend like that he was a map reader. Not pretend, he told me he was a map reader. And that he spent most of the war walking around in circles to avoid conflict. That was. Whereas Philip then became a conservative member in England, right? Became a great football scout as well. And he was a great soccer player. And he played with the British Combined Services. During the war. And then we got letters back from my first cousin in England when I was doing some article recently. And there you have letters from him to Knott's Forest manager. This fella's coming back. He went up to the Middle East after the war, serving the British Army. Could be a handy fella, you know. And there was kind of correspondence between different footballers, you know. So sport was a massive thing in the family. Dick then, the younger guy, he was a lifelong member of the British Labour Party. He followed Philip over. And then my father is a mad Fianna Fáil supporter.
So there was no unity in the family in terms of political ideologies. And
the only unity was when Philip came out of prison, out of a prisoner war camp, they end up in Cork, like, and they go on to Rantan, like, they're the future, and they're going to form a transport company. Now, that all died the following day.
Interesting conversations about politics, anyway, I'd say.
I know, maybe heated after the few pints.
I just love when they'd come home from England, you know. Because you've got a different perspective, you know.
I'd say there was a few of them gas as well, I'd say, characters like.
Oh, they're great characters. Yeah. But they had life experience from very young, you know. So yeah.
They were different people back then too. Even you were saying about your grandmother. Like, I was thinking about my own grandmothers as well as you were thinking about it. And I was saying it and I was saying, they were powerful women. They kept the families together and they were so strong, you know. And the men just done whatever they were told as well, because the women were the ones who fed them and kept everything together while the men.
A strong element of truth of that, you know. Yeah. And what was interesting, I was during the War of Independence period, like, they told me about what they were coming over Parliament Bridge, you know, and there was a British Army checkpoint, and they had a German Mauser, which was the kind of standard issue for the IRA at the time, which came from Germany, and which he headed up her skirts, like. But that time they didn't really search women either.
And
I asked the head of the museum in Dublin about this in a lecture some years ago in West Cork, because this was intriguing me, like, how did they get out of it through? You wouldn't get through today.
No.
And you went to Clochacree Street.
Just to say, my own upbringing was like kind of like the 60s. It was very enjoyable. I mean, I don't know, have you ever read Roddy Doyle's stuff, you know, in Dublin around the 60s and 70s? A bit like that. There was 5, 6, 7, 11, 10 in families, you know, kids everywhere.
Have you many siblings?
We had 5 in our family, two sisters and 2 brothers. I'm a twin. A twin with Paddy. Very handy.
Yeah.
No, he was not identical, but the fellas never messed with him, like. So, do you know what I mean?
Was he boxer like your dad?
He was quiet, like. But if you messed around, fellas knew then, like.
Yeah.
Stay off him a bit, you know.
Yeah, and therefore,
I got away with it in the shelter, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so we used to we'd play soccer up in Belfihan and Belfihan Park. Mm. We had great friends up there. You'd have the same teaming families there. You could get 5 or 6, playing against 5 or 6, you know, on the street, no problem. The Narrow was a very small part of the O'Connell Crescent. That was our theatre of dreams, if you like. So we played soccer. Then Nemo Rangers was close by. Turner's Cross is there.
That's right.
We were Cork Celtic supporters. And we'd be out then in the freezing cold, like, watching them training and all that kind of stuff, you know. And then I joined Nemo because my cousins were involved in Nemo. And Colin Murphy would have been... You know, he won about 8 counties with Nemo. And he asked us one day, myself and Paddy, would you come out to the street leagues? And that was the beginning then of a lifelong sort of membership involvement in Nemo, which is kind of just like your family.
What was your code? Hurling or football or both?
We're more football. We played hurling as well.
Yeah.
You know, that was a great laugh. Like, for Nemo fellas to come up to the north side to play hurling was an act of bravery. You know? We used to have a great... We'd always identified a few fellas who wouldn't get on the bus. Who'd be conveniently missing that day.
Their mother's my phone in. Like, he's sick today.
He's sick today, especially if we're up to play in a Pearshig.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, there'd be a good few... strong supporters on the sidelines up in the Pearshig. But I used to enjoy it. And but
was there a big rivalry even back in your day between the Glen, the Pearshig, and the Southside clubs in the city?
Yeah, but see, I'd have a first fondness for the Glen then because of the father.
That's right.
Yeah, and that still is there, even at the last county final now. Like, I've been kind of teaching that you're kind of minding your manners like a bit, you know. And next minute, there's 5 minutes to go. I think it's a semi final, actually. And Bob Ryan says to me, it's beginning to story. You know,
and you're just mad to scream and start, go on, the Glen! They're all watching you.
But he could feel me going like,
it's on the front of the news then the next day. Oh, God.
So that kind of, that's there because the father would ream off the great, like, the father was in the heyday of Glenn's success, you know, the Rings, Josie Hartnett's, all of those, Donny Donovan, all those people. They were household names in our household.
Yeah.
And then the Glen were the great hurling team and so on like that. And so I think he had a great sporting life. And I think sport was his way to a really good, interesting quality life. He met great people. He toured Italy with the Irish boxing team. That time in the 50s, boxing was massive in Cork. Yeah. And in the City Hall, it would be jammed every Friday night. with people coming out of work, getting their sandwiches, 2 pints into the city hall. Mm. There'd be boxing tournaments on. And when I went into politics, I was knocking on doors in Ballyfihan, and I, you know, had all my ideas, like what I was going to do. And first question, like, are you anything to the champ? You know, that was his nickname, yeah. The champ.
Go there.
Are you anything to the champ? And I said, I am, yeah. Well, if you're half the man he was, no, we'll give you a vote. Like that was, yeah. So I went back. I went back to the team and said, lads, we better put a line into the literature to shine the sun off Paddy Barton, because the rest isn't resonating.
The rest doesn't matter. What doesn't you want to do doesn't matter. It's who you are.
He was the number three boss and he was a boxer. Yeah, and there was a great fight he fought. And look, I've said this before. He fought a guy called Joe Bygraves, who later became British Empire Heavyweight Champion, fought Johansson for the world title. The fighter beat him over 6 2-minute rounds.
Go away with that.
In his early days, obviously, in the City Hall. And that was then the next question. Like, it's not a question. I was there the night he beat Bygraves, you know. Yeah. That's the thing. So anyway, you know.
That's great. That's fantastic.
It's just something to be proud of, isn't it?
Ah, yeah. We kind of, over time, you know, time, yeah.
It's probably when you're younger, you don't really, you can't really appreciate it. When you get a little bit older, you look back, you say, no, I did something, you know, something special.
Yes, you do, yeah. And I think we all got a singlet each then when he died. The sister had them and she just gave us one each, you know, the jersey that he would have worn on the Irish team. And so
we have
on
a lovely Christy ring. Picture on the YCM.
It's
cool, isn't it?
Fantastic, yeah.
But there's a great picture of Christy Ring there training down in the Mardyke with the shaky bridge in the background. Yeah. And there was a brilliant documentary about Christy Ring there on RTA. No, it was the last year, the year before. Like, but it's such a legend of a man, you know, even like his personality and his charisma. But then, like, he played for the Glen, you know, and he was training down in the Mardyke. You know, these places where we frequent.
He was a true legend, you know. Yeah. I mean, my father adored him, like, played Gaelic football with him. Ring was a good Gaelic footballer. Played corner forward with Knicks. And Ring was a fierce competitive person. Like, he hated losing. And
kind of rough around the edges.
If the father made a mistake, like, there'd be murder and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And they got on famously well, you know.
You were telling us he got him a job?
He said to the father, look, I'm leaving CIA, getting a job with this, so there's a job there for you, lorry driving.
That's right.
Which the father took up. And like, they'd have the odd Barney as well. Like, you know, there was a famous story told at my father's wedding by the best man. I won't go into this too long, like, but basically the father had fought in Milan the previous week against a guy called De Signy, who was the European champion. And they'd fought twice, Rome and Milan. De Signy won. Father comes back next week, plays with St. Nick's, makes a hames of it, tries the ball wide. Ringy gives him a kind of, what were you doing? Like, he said, you could have tapped the ball into the net. A few expletives in between, but you had to blast it wide. The father, you could have had your name up in lights, Ring said to him, you know. Mm. If you tapped it in, the father said, don't you be talking to me about having your name up in lights. He says, when you're out in Milan. He says, up in lights, he says, Martini Irlanda versus De Signy Italia. And you can talk about having your name up in lights.
It's true, wouldn't it?
I was told that when he was 17.
There's not many people put Christy Ring in their place, imagine.
He taught us then, you see, which I've taught my kids, which is kind of a bit mad. Like, but the father said to me, don't ever let anyone tell you that anyone was better than Christy Ring, right? Mm. In hurling, or that anyone ever will be, you see. So I kind of grew up as a gospel. Yeah. And I told my fella then, when he was 4, look, I said, there'll be all sorts of debates and arguments, but don't you ever let anyone tell you that there was anybody better than Christy Ring. Mm-hmm. Jack Lynch died about a year or two later, and my house in primary school, and the teacher was saying, we must all pray now for Jack Lynch. I know, this is my foot says, everybody's praying for Jack Lynch, and there's nobody praying for Christy Ring. He says, so, like, talk about the capacity to indoctrinate.
You went to Chris Rees School, you were involved in the, you never got into boxing yourself?
No, we never. This, it kind of died down in the 60s in the Cork. The mother wasn't keen about it. We got boxing gloves from Santi. And we'd box in the front garden and we'd box in the front room.
Mm. What was it like in school for you?
I loved it. Genuinely, I just adore. I mean, Cree Street to me was just a bit of magic, really, you know.
Yeah.
We went to the Skull Cree Street, you see, we were just around the corner.
Mm.
And then we automatically went into secondary school.
Yeah.
It was like, we're a big sporting family, you kind of gather that now. So when I went in 1973 to Clash Cree Street, Cork are in an All-Ireland final, right? There's about 8 past pupils from Cree Street on that team. So the first month in Cree Street in history class, there's a brother Cullum there, the late brother Cullum. And he spends that month going through the tactics of how Cork can win the All-Ireland, you know. I mean, this was your introduction to Clash Creek Street. And for me, it was great. Like, there was a great central spine in that team, all this kind of stuff. And then you see, like, Creek Street then, Cork win. I couldn't get to the match. I had a broken hand. I think that was an excuse by the father. He took the twin brother. He probably had only, you know, he couldn't take two maybe.
Yeah.
But I watched it on television and it's still indelibly imprinted in my mind. You know, Jimmy Barrymore for your skinhead at the time. I'd gone to the Munster final in the All Athletic Grounds. Five goals in the semi-final. And Mihala Harris says, Jimmy Barrymore, what's he going to do? It's a goal, you know, I'm not going to take him off now because I get into real trouble. And it was and then they come to Crease Street and that team. When we were in the primary school, Crease Street were winning Hearties, they were winning Corny Varese. So I said it recently at Nemo, like when we were doing an event, because Nemo's 50 sort of anniversary coming up. And we, our centenary, sorry. And I was saying to them, you know, I was born in a kind of golden age of Cork. Football in my parish. Crease Three's flying, Nemo's doing very well, begins to win his first counties, Cork wins in All-Ireland.
Yeah.
And then Cork win three All-Irelands in the mid-70s. Academically, you see, we would have been the first really going to second level in our family. So the mother and father were big into education. That was their aim, get them an education. And so history was my favorite subject, English.
Dissimilar myself. Like when I was in school, it was always history and English. It was what I was most interested in and the strongest at. And it helps you then, you know, in college later on, you know, natural flair for language, a natural curiosity to learn.
Exactly.
Did you have that when you went into your college days?
In college, I found college, we were the first going to college as well, but I found the first year very difficult in college. I get home every night and get back out to Nemo. I used to be training underage teams. I just found it hard to integrate into first year in college. There was a few guys from Crease Street there and a few guys from our kind of background, if you like, there. But then in second year, I opened up, you know, you meet more people. And third year then.
You mature a lot as well. Like when you're a young person, you know, when you were finishing secondary school, did you know what you wanted to do? Or was it just, you went into arts, did you?
I did. Into arts. I wanted to be a history teacher.
Yeah.
I kind of settled on that, you know.
Yeah.
And did the dip, then did a master's in history after the dip.
Was it like,
and I also met Mary, my wife, there as well. So it kind of fell in love then. And some people felt the master's was an excuse.
Your wife was a lecturer for my mother out in CIT when she did the community education development degree. She said that to me last night.
Did she? Yeah, she was. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Hi to me, mum, and hi to your wife.
I tell her that now. Yeah.
But what was it like in university, being the first from your family? And was that like a whole new thing for your family? It was a big thing for your family.
It was, yeah. I think it was. We didn't dwell on it a whole lot. I think the mother loved it. And I often think the mother often would say she wasn't a keen fan of me going into politics. Father was. Although I never saw myself going into politics like when I was in college. No, I joined the Fianna Fáil coming in college. But I never saw myself as a TD. And I say that to young people, you know, don't ever kind of predict, you know, you may go down. What I say to young people is do what you love, do what you like. So I went in to study history and I did what I liked in a way. And people are saying, you'll never get a job as a history teacher. There's very few of them, blah, blah, blah. But you never know where it leads, is my point. And, you know, people, I was just reading this morning about the Entrepreneur of the Year, a guy, O'Sullivan from Moy, like, and he kind of started out never realizing he'd be where he is today, you know. And I think there's a bit of that in life too, you know, and you can't with precision kind of predict what you're going to do in life.
And there's no such thing as a wasted education.
No.
Like you could go in and do arts. You might never work in that specific topic, but the transferable skills you learn along the way, you know, scheduled in, working towards a deadline, you know, time management, you know, pursue, like starting something and finishing something. These are all character building that you could take into any industry
that
later
so
on.
True, yeah.
It gets you ready for life as well. Like, you know, like when I left college after doing the degree in construction management, like the stress levels that were created during doing all the assignments in third and fourth year, when I came back out, the stress of the construction industry at the time was it was ridiculous. People falling, you know, it actually got me ready for the outside world.
That's an interesting point, you know, because like you're saying that sort of the actual stress of doing the exams and stuff stands to you later on.
It gets you ready for when you're actually going out there and you're on site.
I read a book when I was doing the HDIP by a guy called John Holt. Don't know him. You do a bit of psychology like when you're doing the dip, right? And he said the greatest motivating thing in life is the fear of failure, which I thought was extraordinary revelation when you think about it. And I remember, do you know the way in some courses you're not studying as well as you maybe should be?
Or
and you're kind of, you're suddenly the deadline's arriving, like, and you've got to examine about 3 days, and I remember looking at myself in the mirror saying, you're some idiot, to myself, you know, before I got down to try and get ready for the exam, you know. And that was the motivation, like, you're not failing this thing.
Like, not like a deadline to get something done, isn't it?
No. Or the fear of failure, like, it's a fear of failure. That's not a healthy pressure either.
No, it's not.
But I do get your point about the sort of, what you're saying, the stresses and, you know, because I felt the leaving cert was the toughest exam I ever did.
Oh, really?
Psychologically preparing for it. I didn't find third level as tough.
Was that pressure you put on yourself, or was it pressure
it's your first major exam,
parents?
The parents want us to X, Y, and Z. Like, the mother would love when I would read a short story that I'd written.
Yeah.
She thought I'd be a writer or something like that, you know. But the mother, in fairness to them, they had the balance right, you know. But their job was to, they saw it as making sure you got the opportunity, you know. But I think we do, you know, the Leaving Cert, by even now, I keep saying to you, it's the toughest exam you'll ever do, I say to students.
Do you think there's a lot of pressure?
I think there is. And some of it's maturity. Like, our kids all started at 5. And that was a kind of conscious decision of ours. They're older when they're doing the Leaving Cert. No, the other side of that is you're older when you're doing a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But you're more mature going through second level.
Right.
And I think, I used to teach adult education. You know, I used to do night classes for Leaving Cert repeats when I was in St. Karen's College in Camden Place, Key. And their motivation was huge.
Mm.
There was never a problem. Not everyone's motivation is where it should be at 18 or 19. You know, it's natural that an 18-year-old might have other things on his or her mind.
Yeah.
And we're expecting, look, there's no other way of doing it in some respects, but we're expecting everybody to be optimally at the exact point at 18 years of age in our system, right? And that's not the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's got much better since our day in the sense that you have pathways now, you have FETAC, HETAC, which I was involved in bringing in education. And I think the most important thing we've changed in the last 20-odd years is that the learner is becoming center stage now as opposed to the institutions. There was a lot of snobbery between universities, institutes of technology, or the regional colleges at the time, and colleges of further education.
Mm.
Whereas there shouldn't really be, like, it should be, how can we enable that person to get from A to B, irrespective of what location they're doing the study?
Yeah.
And I remember Dick Langford, who was a former CEO of the Cork City VUC, was a great leader in education in this city, and he became the national head of what was TOGASC at the time and what became the qualifications framework. And he made that point to me many years ago, you know, this really is about making the learner centre, not the institutions.
Yeah, in my previous employer there, Cork ETB, but in my time there, you know, we would have worked with UCC and CIT, but there was tremendous collaboration there. And it was even my role now with Drug and Alcohol Service, if I'm helping somebody in an application for a college and you generally kind of throw an access officer or something in the colleges, they'll, like, it's dependent on the needs of the learner, and CIT will refer into UCC if that's the most appropriate, and vice versa. You know, so I echo what you're saying there. Like, the learner is at the centre of it, and there is great collaboration in Cork between the institutions that probably traditionally would be more kind of competitive against each other for the learner.
Yeah, and like before the qualifications framework came into being, the levels, you know, FETACs and HETACs. Like, you could get a primary degree in CIT and it would hardly be recognized in terms of getting onto a master's. You wouldn't get the recognition you deserve if you want to go to university, you know. And there was a lot of that going on of institutional snobbery. And I think it's been transformed and it needs to continue. And in fairness to the current presidents of both institutions and the colleges and the VC of ETB now, they're all working much more, as you say, collaboratively together to help people.
And I think the FETACs and the QQI courses, like, they were, like, mean to me, they didn't go straight into university or CIT. You start out on your level fours or level fives, that's a brilliant route for a lot of people.
That's it, like, that was the whole idea of that, you know.
And we spoke about it the last day when you were up in terms of Mike Sweeney, the college. It's not every route. It's not for the one route is not for everybody.
I keep saying that to people.
Because some people aren't ready for college immediately after secondary school. No. You know,
they're not because
like my own experience with being inside in the classroom out in college with 18 and 19 year olds, the first year, at least half of the class falls off because a lot of the lads are from the country and they're coming in, have the free roll, and they're not used to being free from the mother and father, and they're stuck in the college and they're out every night, and their studies then are being left at the side, you know. And when we got into the fourth year and fellas scrope through the first 3 years, I see, and they were about 21 years of age, I see fellas just flourishing, just like overtaking people, like just
really, yeah,
unbelievable. Yeah. And I seen one guy in particular, like, but there was six or seven of them, and they were all, they just took off in fourth year because they knew it was the year. No, yeah, we can't mess about. But they also matured.
Yeah,
you know, I think it's fantastic. And like it took me, it took me 30 years to mature to that level. But you know, like, you know, my education journey started at 32, and then
I was reading about that, which I think is extraordinary. Yeah, you know, because I did.
Yeah,
because remember, I was doing, I'm big into early education, you know, and I read somewhere, you might not hear this, but we all learn more in life between 0 and 3 than we will for the rest of our life, right?
Perfect.
So the importance of really stimulating and helping the 0 to 3 group is central to later performance, later kind of confidence and all of that, you know. But for what you did, that was extraordinary.
Yeah,
if you don't mind me saying so.
Oh, 100%.
To be able at 32 to pick up, and I read how you did your reading, did the alphabet, did everything, like literally.
You said it earlier on there about education. Education is critical. And for me, like, I lived a life of crime before that for many years because I knew nothing else. I grew up in a neighborhood where crime was all we ever knew. But when I went into, when I stopped using alcohol and drugs and I didn't want to be involved in crime anymore because I had young kids, I knew that education was my key to something else. I didn't know at the time, you know, but I knew if I educated myself and learned more about life, that the limits of this, it's limitless. I could do anything with my life, you know?
Absolutely. And it's both career-wise, but also in your own development. Like, I mean, just to pick up a book and be able to read it or watch a debate or whatever, you know, enjoy a bit of music.
But even like to be able to sit and have a conversation with the Taoiseach, you know what I mean? Like it gives you the confidence, it gives you the vocabulary to have more agency with your life, you know what I mean? To start podcast, to be able to be an advocate for others who aren't as fortunate as us, you know, and to be able to kind of, you know, like it's just, it's great. But something that you talked about there around the pressures of the leaving, sort of like, there is a lot of pressures on certain students and students in general to like know what you want to do for the next 4 years, you know what I mean? But for a lot of the time, a level 5 in the College of Com, St. John's or Stefan Efa, you can grow a lot and mature a lot in that 12 months.
Correct. I think it's very important that young people keep getting that message that there's a number of routes now to where you want to get and not to panic, you know?
Exactly.
And lots of routes there now.
And it's not a lesser route either.
No, absolutely not. In fact, it can be a more enhancing route.
Of course it can.
We should probably be saying that a lot of the parents need to know that.
They do.
I was speaking to one lady yesterday at a job and she was telling me about her daughter going through secondary school and doing the leaving cert the year before or whatever. And she said, fucking hell. She said, the amount of pressure. She said, I actually thought she was going to have a breakdown.
Yeah.
She said, what if you do? And I have a daughter who's 14 and she's doing the junior this year. And she said, just leave her off. She'll grow. She'll find her own way. Leave her off. Don't pressure them, because you can imagine the amount of pressure they're putting on themselves as is. And it makes a lot of sense. And what we were just saying about like, the leaving sort of parents, don't pressure them, leave them, they'll find their own way. We all will find our own way eventually.
Find our own way, and guidance is more important than sort of, you know, you got to guide people in a direction, you know. They know themselves too, you know.
They do.
You know, people kind of have their own sort of doubts.
Yeah.
I keep saying, one message I say to young people and is that very few of us have confidence actually in ourselves. And I say to young people, and I like going into classrooms, I get a bit of energy from talking to young people. Is, you know, try and develop self-esteem and self-confidence, because those are the keys. And I would say, like, a lot of industries say to me, multinationals, that they can't get over the quality of Irish people and young Irish people that come into their companies. And I kind of say that back to young people, to say that they're talking about you, actually. You know, you need to believe a bit more in yourself. I think the modern era, it's gone much better. I go to the young scientists. I've been going to young scientists every year for the last 20-odd years. I'd spend hours there meeting young people and so on. No, I can't the last 2 years because it's virtual.
Yeah.
I believe that's one of the most optimistic things I go to.
And we've clashed the column. They won that in a couple of years. And then,
they're fantastic.
Blarney won it for a couple of years as well.
Kinsale.
That's right. Yes,
Cork is one of the strongest counties in it.
That's right.
And I think that goes back to the Science Teachers Associations of yesteryear, who you've come and promote science in the city and in the county. And I suppose the fact that we've industry now, life sciences, you know, the pharmaceuticals, the medical device companies, the Apples, that's all spawning kind of an interest in those areas, you know.
You said something there, which I wanted to pick up on, but it was around when you speak to multinationals, you know, they're always kind of complimenting to it. There could be some skepticism around like, oh, they're only here for the taxes and all that, you know, but it's actual genuine interest in the quality of the Irish workforce.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, there would be. I mean, many of them are here a long, long time now.
Yeah.
Like you take Eli Lilly in Kinsale, for example. And I was on to them recently. They've now built the largest solar farm in Ireland, in a farm that they used to use for cows and that. Yeah. They just wanted a buffer zone around the factory. But they've been the bedrock of that area industrially and around the Kinsale area. It's the quality.
We grew up next to Apple Computers in Hollyhill as well, which is the European headquarters. Mm.
And again, they will say to you, you know, in pharmaceuticals or in Apple, it's the quality of the workforce gets them through, you know.
But we need them here as well, Michal. We need these companies here to
employ. I remember Apple was nearly gone here. Joe Gantley went out to...
Going to leave, like?
Yeah, but it was on the cusp. We nearly, you know. But then he went out to convince them that we could do a lot more than just assembly here. Mm-hmm. And so helps you. You've all these range of functions that are carried out now in Hollyhill.
Yeah.
That's for Europe and for the EMEA region, Asia and so on. So it's a very important centre for Apple. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Clash de Colum, actually, they did really well on the school feeders table, public school. But we had a conversation around this. It's in the news at the moment, but we spoke with Phil O'Flynn from the Terence McSweeney. And the school feeder table is great for some schools, but it's not to take from the people that go into apprenticeships and the College of Comms and the St. John's either, you know what I mean? Because
I don't believe in school feeder tables. Like,
no.
In fact, one of the things I did as Minister for Education was to ban league tables.
Yeah.
Because they're not fair comparators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, bit by bit, they're sneaking out different ways, you know. That's but right. Not everybody agreed with me. But my views were very clear that, you know, it was creating an unfair perspective. I mean, to me, teachers in schools where there would be much more challenging situations, they're performing
unbelievable
beyond the limits in terms of what they're doing, you know, in enabling people to get on a life journey and enjoy education and get through education.
Mm.
Like I knew Phil, I was in college with Phil. Like,
oh, that's right, Jesse said that.
We did Irish, same Irish class. I did Irish and history with a major in that. Like, I think there's a lovely atmosphere in the school.
Yeah,
I've been up there a couple of times now in the last 2 years, and it's like a community as opposed to a school. That's the sense I have.
It's changed dramatically,
and it's around like the development of the young person. Academic is important, and be able to recite Irish poetry and be able to know Shakespeare and Macbeth and come out of school. Mm-hmm. Now, that's all important, but you need life skills too.
You need life skills, they do
the restorative practice. Another school that you'd be familiar with would be the Cork Life Centre.
Yes.
And Dan would be a friend of our own as well. Like, but it's about the development.
I was working with Dan all year to try and get things sorted. Right. Like, tough man. But I hope to call down there like at some stage.
He's done a tough time himself at the moment.
I know that. And our thoughts and our support are with him, you know.
Exactly.
That school. Me and James have been speaking about what they do in that school, and if the likes of me growing up had something like that around that area,
there was a chance.
I would have had, my life could have been a completely different place, because I could have never sat inside in a classroom and focused because of a diagnosis of being dyslexic. And whatever was going on at home. But if we had something like that, where it's more of a focus on the actual student themselves and what they are capable of doing instead of what they can't do, I think if we had more schools like that.
You see, I remember way back in the 90s, Youth Reach came into its own, right? Which was seen as an alternative model for young people.
Wife works for my Youth Reach.
Oh, does she? Very good, yeah. Because Bertie Ahern led that actually from the Ministry for Labour. It's interesting. It didn't come from education originally. But then that's done by the ETB. I remember Father Rocks of years back down in Father Matthew Street used to do something similar. Now, Don has moved it on and in terms of the Life Centre. It's
quite
separate,
unique now, isn't it?
Quite unique. But I think the message is really like, there's no one size fits all.
Yeah.
This is a challenge because we're a small country. Nationally, our education system is seen as a good one, good quality overall, right, teaching, et cetera, et cetera. So the system has always been reluctant or has lacked the flexibility to accommodate different models. And if you accept that it's not one size fits all, now there's a review going on at the moment as to how we can create a kind of a system that would facilitate the Life Centre and others across the country. Because invariably they start off either on a voluntary basis or a kind of charitable basis, people supporting it or funding it. And it's very difficult then to get into the mainstream of funding. And we've created a lot of funding this year for the Life Centre. But again, it's just it's this kind of tension between the system and new ways of trying to bring people into education, keeping people in education and facilitating people with different attitudes and because young people are all different, you know?
Everybody,
just the ethos of like the academic part is important, but it's not the most important thing. And you said earlier on, like, you know, people have the innate ability to self-actualize and find their own way. And
it's also a refuge for people, like, at a given stage in their life. Like, refuge might be the wrong word, but kind of an oasis.
A safe space, like.
A safe space, and that's important, you know, without the fear of and in the past, that wasn't there. Like, historically, if someone wasn't performing, it's called, you know, had dyslexia. Very often, they were sent to the back of the class or sent out of the class or sent out of the school.
And we were speaking about that. We were speaking about dyslexia before we started, like, and just to bring it up again, like, maybe down the line, I was telling you that I was on a radio station recently, being asked about my own dyslexia, and because it was being brought in by the UK government that inside in all schools, kids would be screened, you know, at a young age, so they can get whatever help. And we were speaking about, do you think we're actually much behind them in maybe getting that down the line, or is it something that we have to start off initially, like getting funding for different schools ourselves?
That's my view is that we need to get the I hate using the word experts or those together, because there was a view that waiting for assessment, people weren't getting help in schools until they got a diagnosis. And so the switch was, let's give people help before they get the diagnosis. My own view is we should be diagnosing much earlier in terms of early assessment, because you need to know the particular issue that a child might have so that you can tailor your response to the child's needs, as opposed to have a general view. So I don't think we're quite there at all yet in that respect, but I do think we need to, and we need to watch very carefully what's happening in the UK on that front. In my view, and it's easier said than done in terms of the range of people you have available to do proper diagnosis and so on. Now, there's a lot has happened in the last year with Anne Rabbit in terms of assessment. The next thing after assessment then is referrals and getting interventions. Like, my own view is, and it started, we need more therapies in the schools. So I believe that the therapists should be part of a school team. Now, that was the way in special education. And what happened then over the last decade or so, progressing disability has developed within the HSC, whereby you go to a centre that's organised by the HSC, but you leave your school or classroom, not you don't leave the school, you know, you're still in the school, but you go out to get assessed. Whereas I think multidisciplinary inputs are much more effective, so that the therapist is talking to the teacher, they're talking about John or Mary and how they're getting on. And it's a multidisciplinary team-based approach. I think that's the optimal way to help children.
There's a school on the south side there, Southley Educate Together, Dave Cashman, a Rockies man, is the principal down there, but it's very much around being trauma-informed and to be able to identify a child that's suffering some sort of maybe a childhood trauma or adverse childhood experience is the term, the ACEs, but like if the child is acting out or the child can't sit still or the child is misbehaving, it's not like labelling them as bold and putting them outside the door. It's like, investigate what's going on,
what's going on here
and being able to identify that, you know, but maybe that's not a part of core teaching courses.
Well, you see, when various schemes for disadvantage or DESH came on, and in the earlier years when drug task forces were set up in the 90s and 2000s, and I was involved in the area partnership in Mahon, for example, and so on, where we had psychological teams, and I would meet them and they would say to me, you know, exactly what you just said, that we don't know what a particular child might have gone through before they've arrived in the school gate.
I know.
The last thing they're prepared to think about is there's something that's going on in their head. They're not listening. They're not focused. And I thought it was interesting. One psychologist said to me that every child needs a friend in school, someone that they can go to in authority to say, look, I have a problem and so on. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the teacher. It could be somebody. I think we need to double down again on that in schools to give the extra resources that the child has a friend in school, but that also we're better at identifying what's going on here, as you say.
And not just their schools either, you know.
It's every school, really, where a child has a problem.
But
to integrate that into the...
Yeah. Even in more affluent areas, you know, there could be serious stuff going on at home there, you know what I mean? And the
point taken, of course.
If we go back to your story,
yeah,
we know we're all very passionate about education, so it's great to talk about education. But I'd love to know, like, how you got into politics and what was the draw to Fianna Fáil? What was your early memories of politics? And is there anybody you like looked up to, Jack Lynch, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the father was the biggest influence in my life. We lived so near Crease Street, like we get home every day for dinner. Like, students might not understand that today. We'd have lunch at home, like cabbage and bacon, whatever the mother had on, like in you go. Father, we couldn't open your mouth, 1 o'clock news is on. So we're all listening to the 1 o'clock news as you're eating the lunch, right? And the father would be commenting. So, I suppose current affairs began then, like, And my mother's family were Fianna Fáil. The father was more thinking, I don't mean that to disparage my mother, she was just certain, moving her. But the father would think and give you different perspectives. But school then, there was a great teacher in sixth class, Tommy Land. And I think later on in life, he didn't bother preparing for the entrance exam to get into Crease Tree. Right, so if you that thing with streaming, you know, so he was doing things like I was doing Around the World in sort of 30 minutes. I was doing broadcasting at 12, and what I didn't realize is he was helping with elocution research. I was doing this naturally. Then he broke us up into groups, and he'd leave the class and have a row there about politics. He'd say, "My brother was making crystal sets. My twin brother. I go home. He had wires down to the backyard, and we get Radio Luxembourg, like, it's kind of magic, like." And he went off to do science then in CIT and that, like, and that teacher to me, Tom Land, like, was a genius, you know. And he was the first teacher. The next teacher was Tony Power in Crease Street. He was my English teacher, fifth year, sixth year. He would want us to watch 7 days. The prime time of its time was called 7 days. You might see it on Reeling in the Years now. So he'd say, "You go home now and watch that, and I want you to talk about it tomorrow." Only about 5 of us would do it. Mm. The rest of the class copped on very quickly that this was a great way. They could come in with no homework done and get away with it, because he did say to me, "Oh, look, would you ever get from talking about 7 days again?" I'd be saying, 2 other fellas be arguing with us in 7 days last night. And the rest of them would be thrilled, keep it going as long as you can. And so that was, I think, interesting in current affairs. No, I still wasn't thinking of going into politics. My first major rally I went to was 1977. Jack Lynch. My father, like, made us sit down and watch Jack Lynch's Ardèche speeches, which at that time were an hour long. Mm. And he'd be kind of every now and again, "Look at that, without a note, he's fantastic," and all this kind of stuff, because he played football with him. Yeah.
Jack Lynch was a Shandon man, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And then Sean French was the guy that ran with him. And Sean French was another Glen man, St. Nick's man. The father would be telling me stories how they got Sean nominated and so on like that. The father was a very good friend of Sean French's. And then Dan Wallace later came along, and I was influenced by Dan Wallace as a student. I'd canvassed for Dan Wallace. Mm. That's how I got involved then, because so the father would go and do the canvassing during elections. He'd come back. So it was in the household, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I went to college, I joined Fianna Fáil. Well, why? Because I suppose that background is there.
Yeah.
Education, because I'd done O'Malley and free second level education. Right, yeah. And this was a big thing in our family. We were kind of, in many ways, a family that kind of came along that tide.
Because we take it for granted.
We take it for granted now, you see.
Free education, but it wasn't always like that.
So, and then the North, what young people today will not understand. The North was the reason I got involved in politics. Like, Northern Ireland was in flames.
Thomas Gould said the same around the hunger strike time.
I was 1968, 69, I was 8 or 9 years of age. From then on, it's bombs and bullets on the screens. And so much so that when I was in college, in my last year in the degree program, 4 of us went up to the North during that hunger strike period, and we met everybody.
What was it like?
It was very tense. And we met the UDA first. And Christor de Barod, who passed away recently, he was the founder of an organization called Between. And he used to create a refuge in Cork, out in Spur Hill, for loyalist prisoners' wives and Republican prisoners' wives. And they'd come to Cork for the holidays with their kids. And he kind of went up to him. He gave me a bit of advice about going up to West Belfast and all the rest of it. And then he said, "Who's meeting you on the UDA side?" I said, "We don't know. We just rang them up and wrote them a letter." And I said, "You need to be very careful." He said, "If someone overheard that, like, or some other code your hair there, so you could be in real trouble, like, you know.
Be seen as a traitor or something, like.
No, no, that there could be a fella trying to do damage to you. Others in the UDA circle, stuff in the south. But in fairness to the UDA at the time, like, they had spotted that themselves, and they said there'd be a West Indian meeting at the train station. You know, and so that you won't get picked up by the wrong people. So we were brought to the UDA. No, they had a young guy who was meant to be young UDA.
Okay.
And it turns out afterwards, when we went to a guy called Alf Midgley, who was a social worker in the Shankill, and his father had been a labourer MP in the north in an earlier period. He was fascinating. And he said, was there a young lad there with Andy Turley? I said, there was, he was representing young and UDA. No, no, he said he was his security. So we learned a lot on that trip. Yeah. And I remember then we were getting a taxi out of the Shankill. And we had a guy with us who was from Dundalk. He became fairly significant in law later on in life. And he was a bit really, very outspoken on the hunger strikes and so on like that. And there were certain things you said and didn't say in different communities. Mm. So he kind of nonchalantly said to the taxi driver coming out of East Belfast, out of Shankill, like, and he knew from the Kesh, you know, because one hunger striker was very close to dying on that occasion. And the taxi driver let rip. And I was really afraid at that stage. Like, and we were in the back. So we asked him what was the results cross channel. Now, this is July. That's how kind of tense we were, you know. That's the results.
But he didn't ask him about the hurling results.
Actually, right? Exactly. No, but he says, the soccer seasons were over a long time ago, you know. Exactly. So, yeah. So anyway, he was fine and he dropped us off. We went to West Belfast. We went to make a social worker there. We were taken around West Belfast saw the housing, met the SDLP, met Sinn Féin, met Alliance Party, met everybody that you could meet. It was a very formative experience. Met young unionists. And that really was a turning point in a way, because we met them in their homes. Mm. And it got kind of hot, it got really hot. Because what that taught me, they'd say to us, you say it it's a uniform being shot. It's my uncle, or it's my father.
I know.
And it got very hot in the sitting room. To me, violence could never unite people, you know, and the scars of that are still there. And so later in life, when I did get into politics, I maintained that interest in the North, and I was asked to go along to the British Irish Association, which is an event that's held every year, either in Oxford or Cambridge, where everybody to do with the North at the time, British Army, RIC politicians, British politicians, Irish politicians, civil servants would meet off the record. And that enabled people to sort of say, what could you cope with if we move that? And bit by bit, you learn a lot more about the other side, to speak. And then I went to Ballycastle on another occasion. I keep referring to that, which was a Quaker-led reconciliation centre, or get to know you. And there was 24 of us, 12 TDs, 12 unionists, loyalists.
Yeah.
And it was very funny because... David Irvine, who had spent time in prison, Irvine were going on concentric circles when I arrived on a Friday evening. They have all these techniques, so go around and stop. Who's opposite? Irvine's opposite me, you know.
Yeah.
And they'll ask each other who's the biggest influence in your life. And I said, well, my father was the biggest influence in my life. And he said, Gusty Spence, who was in jail and who had been found guilty. Irvine was a very intelligent man.
Yeah.
And to me, a great insight into our thinking. Mm. And so...
Do you think that if people are exposed to the other side a bit more, it might kind of bring more understanding? There was every year pre-COVID times, but there's a criminology conference, North-South Criminology Conference, and UCC hosted it there about 2 years ago now. Garda Commissioner came down and all that, but there's an organisation in the North called Wave Trauma, and there was 5 speakers came down, nationalists and loyalists, but this guy his story stuck with me, but he was a loyalist. He was a Protestant guy, but his wife was blown up inside in a bookies or a butcher's or something.
Chip shop, was it?
Yeah. And he explained that. And you can be kind of naive from the South thinking IRA fighting for freedom, but then the realities of it, is innocent women being blown apart. And then you would get to think maybe it's time to move beyond the violence. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, that's my point. Here the narrative was too simple down here. Mm. And that's what I meant when I went up on that visit. That kind of sat to me thinking, hang on a second, there's a lot of different angles to this than simply Brits out, which was the kind of the thing in this 50s, 60s, 70s.
Mm.
We thought it was simple in the Republic. It's not simple. Lots of different identities, But then it's interesting, even when I met the UDA, like, they were very annoyed at the British commentators calling Ulster drivers British. It's kind of weird. You know? Yeah. They take umbrage at that then, like, you know, that but there is an Ulster sort of unionist identity that has to be accommodated. And then a lot of people want to get on with life. A lot of people want to get on with life, and particularly in the current situation. Like, I never thought I'd see a Good Friday Agreement when I was young. Mm. Never thought I'd be in a government that was there when the Good Friday Agreement happened. I had to pinch myself because, you know, when you're 30 years, like, listening to the same thing on the bulletins, you're saying this will never end.
Mm.
And we actually grew accustomed to it.
I know we've a whole generation of people that don't know anything about what you grew up. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, they don't know anything of bombs or anything like that, Like, I remember when I was a child, you had Oma and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, but does
take a long
my
time.
Nephews know, they don't know anything like that. Isn't that great?
Exactly. Like, you know? And
there's still a lot of work to be done.
We need to learn from it. We need to work and keep engaging is what I'd say. And that's why I'm doing this Shared Island agenda in my department. I've started a Shared Island unit. We're doing stuff on biodiversity and climate on an all-island basis. We're doing greenways on an all-island basis. We'll fund it.
Yeah.
Just practical things. But also dialogue. So we had Patrick Keelty recently who just went viral in the speech he gave to the Shared Island Dialogue series.
Mm.
We have women meeting. Also new communities now, like the New Irish are in the north as well as the Republic. Yeah. What's their thoughts like?
You spoke a while ago of alliance parties when you were a young student, but that's huge at the moment.
They're
isn't
big now. Yeah, they've grown very significantly now.
I think you were elected into this Cork City Council in 1985. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've gone.
That was the era. That was the era I was born. That makes you feel better. But
that's great, isn't it?
You were Lord Mayor in 1992.
I was, yeah.
So that was a huge honour at the time.
That was a fabulous honour. Yeah, I loved it. And it was, for Mary and I, it was probably one of the best years of our lives. First citizens, we just worked every day. Like, we never took a holiday check because we were so in love with the job. Mm. And it gives you a great insight into Cork. Like, you just meet every voluntary group, you meet every sporting group, people have great respect for the office.
Yeah.
And then I brought a lot of students, I developed a history competition. Actually, Councillor Kieran McCarthy there. I know he was the winner of the secondary level side of it at the time. He's an independent councillor on the south side. And Ballyfihan, I was a great story. The Ballyfihan Primary School won it. It was a trip to New York, for 5 days. Got sponsorship from Aer Lingus and all this kind of stuff. And I'd go to all the schools and say, listen, I have just competition about history, learn about your city, etc. And all of you could win it. And Mary said, stop saying that to the primary schools. They're building up their hopes, you know what I mean? Well, presentation primary in Ballyfihan came in with a massive model of the medieval city that they must have spent months putting together. Mm. And there was proper judges there, and all that, Art Banbury and all these people. And they won it. And the sister perpetuate it was only at the time. Oh, they went to New York. Like, great crack. So what I loved doing that was bringing children into City Hall. Yeah. And what people said to me, I didn't realize many kids didn't really know what City Hall was about. And some thought it was a dental hospital or something like that, because people just get their teeth taken out long ago in the city.
When I was young, I was thinking it was like a nightclub because it used
that's what was going through my head.
Used to be DJs on in the city hall in the 90s.
There's a few nightclubs with dollar politics
there. There used to be raves inside in the big hall years and years ago.
That's right.
But when I came in 85, it's funny, like, the water charges is the big issue.
Yeah.
Like, it's like life coming back around again. Water charges was the massive issue, you see. And there'd be crowds in the auditorium, watching on, like. And the first year, Dino Cregan, I think, became Lord Mayor. And Dino we couldn't get the vote through then for the estimate to 6 months later, and Dino's Lord Mayor. It goes on till about 2 a.m. He brings in the chips then, because, you know, he's the chippers. And so all the chips come in at about 2 a.m. for people to eat. kind of stuff. And eventually we get it through by a vote or two.
Yeah.
I'm Lord Mayor the next year then. And again, I'm mixed up. That's 91, 92, but I'm Lord Mayor the following year. But water charges was the dominant issue from 85 right through until I think the Labour Party time in 97 abolished them. Because Dublin never had them. The rest of the country did.
Mm.
And they were getting by with them because you could do waivers that time for families who were more difficult there, for pensioners and that.
Yeah.
And then it was dead from 97 until... more recently, it came back again. So it's kind of
interesting. Came back with a bang.
Yeah, it came back with a bang. And it was I remember, I think it was someone said, like, I could see that this was going to become an issue again. Whatever it is with water and Irish people, it's a bit like the field.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
It just sparked something. And that issue went on for years. And we said these late night talking about, and not quite DJs now, or discotheques aren't they, but there was a lot of late night sessions because of water charges in City Hall from about 85
just an excuse, really, right through water, to the early water charges were the excuse
right through to the early nights water charges were the excuse.
But you had a tremendous amount of ministerial positions down through the years. I know you're a Taoiseach, but one thing that I wanted to ask you was, what was it like? Like, you're, for all intents and purposes, you're a regular guy from Turner's Cross, you know what I mean? You're in this important position. How do you deal with it, living in a world where some people hate you and some people love you? Like, and it's like, no matter what decision you make, or no matter what you say, there's going to be a whole lot of people you're going to piss off.
Wouldn't say here. I'd say a lot of people are so, like,
they're not going to make everybody happy, I suppose.
Exactly. And people,
most people, by the way, in life are regular guys. Regular people. That's the first thing I'd say to young people. Like, look at your T-shirt. And that doesn't really, it's not the office you hold. It's how you conduct yourself in the office. And so I try not change personality. I am who I am.
Exactly.
And I treat people with respect.
Okay.
In civil servants and so on. And they can get a bad name and all the rest of it. But you got to look, it's like anything. You got to work as a team. You won't achieve if you don't accept it's a team-based approach. You can go shouting and roaring, all right, for two months, but suddenly things won't begin to happen, you know? So I loved education. Like, to become Minister for Education was a dream. You know, and I had a clear, because I was opposition spokesman for 3 years, so I had a clear agenda. And to be fair to the top civil servants in education at the time, they ran with it. We got an awful lot done. And in terms of special needs education at the time, it was a bit of a revolution at the time. We brought in an automatic pupil-teacher ratio, which for children with special needs, which they didn't have in mainstream education up to then, until 1998. So that was the beginning, really, of mainstreaming of special needs in national schools. It's technically slower in secondary schools, but it's happening also. And then we did a big thing in research, technology, all of that kind of stuff, and did, primary school curriculum. So I love that. And, you know, there was tough sessions with unions and so on like that.
But, how do you deal with the pressures of the job?
Walking.
Having good people around you.
Having good people around you is vital, by the way. And I have very good advisors. My chief of staff, Deirdre Glan, has been with me since her health days. She's put up with a lot now, I can tell you. Like, when she hears me, you know, saying that I'm calm and all the rest of it, she's chuckling a bit, you know.
She's one of Jesus! Inside in the room. Like,
And down through the years, at Christy Mannion in education and in health. And like, they were through the journey on the smoking ban and so on like that. Like, that was hot. Like, that was, you know, you're the big fear, what happens if that goes wrong, you know? And
part of one of the biggest successes in recent political history for Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, it worked very well in the end.
You can imagine what it's after saving us in terms of lives and, you know, fiscal money and everything. Like.
Absolutely. Well, health really is the key ingredient in that, you know, and it will bring down cancers and also help improve our heart disease. I enjoyed health was tough, you know. Health had, you see, you have a number famously called Angola, but you have a number of fires going all the time, like, you know, and you're trying to develop a strategy at the same time and say, you know, we got to get a strategic vision for the future of health. But then there's a book out recently by Mark Henry, Fact at 100, and he takes a more optimistic view of where the country has come in 100 years. But his health statistics are dramatic in the change in Ireland in 30 years in health, in terms of heart disease, strokes, cancer, survival across the board. The biggest one, interestingly, was vaccination.
Yeah.
Because in 1913 to 1920, it was 5,000 a year dying from tuberculosis. Like, vaccination has dealt with that. It's dealt with measles, TB, diphtheria, polio.
TB.
All that, you know. So, like, sometimes we need to stand back from the noise of the moment and sort of say, look, you have to keep your eye on the strategic goal, you know. And that's why smoking, that came into that. Like, if we can get that out of the workplace, you can save people's lives. You can save people going to hospitals. Now, we're living longer as a people, that creates its own pressures and tensions and so on like that. But I think in terms of back to your question, you know, I think you do have to treat people with respect. You have to count to 10 yourself. You're not a know-all, you know, you're not the fountain of all knowledge and so on like that. And you've got to, and learning for teaching, I remember it was Dr. Pettit, who was a famous lecturer in history in Cork, he died recently, said to us, if a child asks you a question in the classroom and you don't know the answer, you tell the child you don't know the answer. And don't pretend you know the answer and give it.
But I can find out for you. There's nothing wrong with saying,
point,
I don't know the answer, but I'd find out for you.
And likewise then, if you're a minister or a teacher, you've got to be prepared to listen and take advice, even if it goes against your instincts. It'll work out in the end, you know.
Yeah. I'll take a little bit off this, you know, the politics and stuff for a while, just back into the family life a little bit. Because behind every man, there is a better woman. And I know that from my own experience, with my own difficulties with drug addiction and stuff like that. And my wife has been my rock, basically, down through the years. She gave me the want, really, to give up the alcohol and drugs to have the life I have today. And your own wife, is she, do you have the same relationship? Is she 100% behind you? We all know you've had your difficulties in the past, you know, with the passing of your children and stuff like that. How do you get on and how do you deal with everything?
We got very well. Yeah. She's looking in.
Choose your next words carefully now.
Well, Mary, I wouldn't be where I am, right? There's no question about that. We met in UCC. We both love UCC because that's where we kind of fell in love when we met. You know the story, we were such great friends before the other thing happens. And Mary's been with me since. And I think, you know, she's a great networker and she is the conscience. She will, no matter where your one office you're in, it doesn't matter if something happens to someone in Cork or Mary's on the phone saying, look, that's so-and-so there now. And she has an incredible memory of people and who is who, who is related to who and who's connected to from Middleton. Mm. Her mother was a Cork McSherry woman. That's why we have the love affair with Cork McSherry. Because when I went out with Mary, I had to go out with Cork McSherry because her childhood years were...
You didn't do too bad.
I didn't do too bad, no. her grandparents were teachers there, actually. Yeah. They were national school teachers in Cork Mac and Timmy League. So, and that's been a great thing for me, you know. We used to go with the father to the other side of West Cork, to Ardfield and Red Strand and all those places. So we've had a kind of a love affair with West Cork as a family. With Chris Ray, I went to West Kerry. Mm. You know, but back to Mary, without doubt, in the early years, she worked in headquarters as a national youth officer. When she left UCC, she was recruited independently of me to Fianna Fáil as a youth officer. Would have had experience of politics at the national level. That was huge for me because she understood the politician's life. Yeah. So she knew I had to be at meetings on a Friday night. I had to be out on the Saturday. In fact, she'd be saying, you have to go to that meeting.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone, say, who had no experience of politics, to marry a politician,
I think, wouldn't know what to get themselves up for.
Yeah, it's a huge... I'm married now to this day, would say to any... perspective, you know, know what you're getting into here because this life, and Mary was saying, it's a very challenging life. She thinks it's much tougher now than it was when we started, because I suppose of the online stuff and all of that. So the fact that she had that intuitive knowledge about what it takes, and she's a good judge and had a bit of cop on as well in terms of the within the party, what's going on externally and so on like that. So it's been, a bedrock, you know?
So, and Timmy alluded to there as well, you had a tremendous amount of tragedy with the passing of your two kids, you know? If not for people that are watching that would be able to have been through similar experiences, what kind of kept you going or what did you do to kind of try to move past it? And, you know, was there any kind of, was it exercise, family, friends?
Yeah, I just said, look, first of all, I'd say I was always very reluctant to talk about it because we've kept it private as a family. Yeah. Yeah. And I found it very difficult in the beginning anyway, to be honest, without getting into difficulty fairly quickly if we're talking about it, because we lost Rory at 5 weeks from the cot death, 1999. And then Lena with a heart condition in 2010. Yeah. But I have learned of late that people do respond to what did you do kind of thing. And we all share the same experiences, actually. That's what you learn. So recently I did do an article with Jen Hogan in the Irish Times, which I didn't expect the response. Yeah. And it mainly was from people who've gone through similar traumas. Mm. And just to answer your question, really, it takes time, first of all. Mm-hmm. The immediate period afterwards is awful, you know. But we had two kids at the time when Rory died. And I always say they pulled us through because you have to get up. You simply have to get up, get them breakfast, play with them, you know. And I remember the time as Minister of Education, and I didn't know what I was going to do, you know, because it's a jolt. It undermines all your certainties in life. So I think exercise, you said it there, is very important. And I often wonder, people laugh at me now because I walk so fast, you know, and they can't keep up. And
Mary's laughing.
there was a funny episode during COP26. the climate change conference in Glasgow, and the British security force, they've got two policemen kind of following you, like, and so I get out of the hotel and I just literally go for it, you know, or somewhere else, and I'm just literally down the road because I want to get mad for the exercise. Yeah, father had that 2 years ago. Yeah. And the man apparently is chasing after me. And by the time he gets to the hotel room, like, he's gone, like, he's in deep trouble. Yeah. So I think the walking is the key to me. And I read that too subsequently, that you do need to get out. Nature is a great healer.
It is.
Yeah. And I love walking. And I walk with friends now, you know, and it keeps you fit as well. Mm. And work is important, getting back to routine. Mm. A good friend of mine, Charlie O'Connor, who was a TD and counsellor some years back, he lost his son. And I remember going up to him and we had a chat. I just said, Charlie, like, it was in the middle of the last local elections, and he was wondering, I said, just don't canvass for anybody. The people will vote you in, but you probably need that council experience later on. You'll need routine in your life.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds very boring, but you do need routine. Yeah. Yeah. And getting back to some order, and you keep going. It never goes away.
Yeah. Mm.
You'll never forget, but you just... You've got to pick yourself up in life. There's,
you have to give yourself time to to give that grieving process a bit of time.
You do. And look, yeah. Mary would say, you know, every person will approach it a bit differently.
Yeah.
There's no kind of model to say to people, this is how you cope. You know, there's coping mechanisms that will work for some people that won't work for others.
I think in any type of recovery, whether it be recovering from a traumatic event like that, or recovering from addiction or child abuse or whatever like that, having a bit of structure to your day can only help you, you know, because it does keep you busy. It gives you something to get up for. But at the same time, there's no harm in just lying there too, if that's what you need to do on that day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, don't judge, like, people be at home and they feel like, oh, but I can't. Don't judge yourself. Don't be too hard on yourself. Give yourself a break and allow yourself time, you know?
Yeah.
And a big part of this podcast is around, like, people, like, sharing, you know, hardships and how they've come through, you know, because it does inspire others and does give hope.
And I think it's okay to cry, like.
It is.
We keep need to tell people that, like, and don't bottle it up, you know. Like, I was lucky. I think our families were fantastic. My brothers, sisters-in-laws, they were superb. They gave us great support and community.
Yeah.
Friends, like, you know, they all rallied, and that helps. Like, there's no doubt about that, you know.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
Quick story. I remember my mother was after dying when I was in the Midlands prison, you know. She died by suicide, and I was inside, and I was in an awful state at the time. I wasn't long off alcohol and drugs, and this will tell you, you know, how trauma informed you are inside there. I was in a bad way, you know. I had a lot of guilt and stuff. I was about 10 months away from alcohol and drugs, and my relationship at the time, my mother wasn't great, because I was going through a lot of therapy in the prison related to my own trauma as a child. And the prison officer comes up to me, and I was in bits, and he says, "Will you have to get over and stop crying?" God. I looked at him, and I had to talk in my throat, you know, from crying, like, and I just, what the fuck? I can't, I said to him, because I was so traumatized. I just said, I can't. I really can't. And it just brought me back when you were saying, like, crying is the most important.
That's the old school way, isn't it?
And it helped me so much, like, that period, like, just crying in the cell helped me.
That must have been an extraordinary experience for you, though.
Unbelievable.
To be in prison when that happened, like.
Going through early recovery as well. Yeah, you know, I was going through a lot of difficulties as well. I had a lot of shame and guilt as well from my actions during during my time. I was involved in drinking drugs and crime and stuff like that. And like, that's one thing you do get when you stop that lifestyle, is you get a massive conscience. And I'd be a sensitive person as well. And all that stuff just came back. I just had a lot of, you know, there's a lot of shame around a lot of the stuff, but that's what happened. And after a while, I would have had this fighter mentality because of my upbringing, you know, having to fight and, you know, being the oldest and being, my mother being a single parent, I had that. And I couldn't surrender into the way I was feeling and just accept the way I was feeling, you know, because you can't cry. You have to be a hard boy, you know. If someone sees you, you'll be vulnerable. They'll take advantage of you. And after a while, it took me a long time, Michal, to really surrender and just stop, and through years of meditation, and just, it's okay to feel the way you feel. you know, and it's okay, okay to cry. Yeah. Yeah. And that's just a little bit of a story.
Thank you.
One of the good things about COVID is in the prisons, they have access to the internet now too, because the video calls and the visits, but they can get YouTube in the prison cell. And our podcast is streamed into the prison cells.
Was it?
And we've recorded a couple of podcasts in Limerick Prison with a female in the library and with a traveller guy in Cork Prison in the school. And we're doing a part of a series with prisoners, you know what I mean? So,
great.
The idea that Timmy can come from that lifestyle and I can come from, you know, addiction and prison like that, but that you can actually go on and still do good things in your life when you get out with the right supports, the level fives, the level threes that you do, the junior sort, these are all beneficial and they help you when you grow. So anybody can, you know, you can go through traumas like what you've went through, you know, with the passing your kids, Timmy with his mother. But we can get through them. It's not the end of the world, you know.
Well, I think the fact that you can give a pathway to people, you can show them, you know,
a very achievable pathway as well.
Very achievable pathway, exactly.
But I won't keep it for too long more. Right. We just wanted to finish up on, since you entered politics, now I'm not giving you all the credit now, but there's after been a tremendous amount of change in Irish society since the mid 80s to where we are now in 2022. Mm. If you were to look back and you were to pick maybe three or four, you know, of the biggest achievements as of Ireland, as opposed to Micheál Martin and Fianna Fáil, but I would probably say the smoking ban is probably one of them. Do you know, the same-sex marriage would probably be another, but there's have to be so many, isn't there?
There has, and I look at it a bigger level. I'd say, first of all, the fact that we're all living longer.
Mm.
We stand back from it. Irish people were dying too young in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. Like road accidents, I was looking at a statistic in that book. I think there was about 458 in 98 dying on roads. It's down to below 130. Still too many.
Yeah.
You know, so that whole thing around that sort of health outcomes, apparently from hospitals on it, but standing back, we're living healthier and we're living longer.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to keep at.
We're taller.
I think we're much more tolerant and liberal as a people. And I think the Eighth Amendment and the marriage equality has taught us that. That whole idea of diversity, and there's difference and you must tolerate difference. And when you look at what's going on in some countries, authoritarian countries now, like I agree with Biden, I think it is that the struggle in the modern era is authoritarianism versus democracy and old-fashioned values of freedom of speech and all of that. That's where I think the big battleground is. And we, in a country here, we have something good going here and we need to keep that going.
Yeah.
And what I worry about at times is there can be intolerances develop. Even with those who think they're modern attack, you know, through an over exuberance of sort of political correctness to say you can't say that again. You know, we need to be tolerant of people. Like people who make mistakes in their lives. You know,
and it's and like go get counter that cancel culture thing.
That thing, I just worry about that because I think
we'd have never been having the possibility to change. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah.
If we just cancelled off stuff that we did years ago, do you know what I mean? So people should be allowed the capacity to change.
The other big change is population growth. That is the biggest achievement. You know, we were losing population up until the 60s, like 1870, like we were 3 million people. We're now close to 5 million people. You know, and now you might say, but that actually gives us critical mass as a society and economy, but it also shows success, like this is a place where people want to live and it's growing. The other big one is, I think, industry. The fact that we really moved from an agriculturally dominant country to one of the most modern post-industrial countries
tech
in the world.
Tech, pharmaceutical,
all of that. And you said it earlier, it's about the quality of the people who are in these factories. They wouldn't be here if they weren't getting the outputs, the quality, the research, all of that. And the other big one is education. I come back to it. We have the highest level, I think, in Europe participation in third level now, I think, in Europe. We have the highest levels of second level completions. And we have to keep, we talked about Life Centre and so on. All those centres help us to get those figures of second level completion high, you know. Because these are things I always look at because I think a child needs to be allowed to complete their education course. Now, thankfully, with FETAC and HETAC, we have the wherewithal to enable them to do that at their own pace. So those are very big things for the country. And we must not lose sight of them because there's a danger that you can lose sight of them. And fourth, I say, is membership of the European Union. That can be controversial from time to time, but that was transformative and has broadened out horizons. It's interesting, the young people of Britain, by a majority, were shocked at the fact that they left the European Union because they saw opportunities for them as young people, you know, to travel across Europe without any inhibitions, without any passports or whatever, you know. And they felt that the older generations left them down by voting
them
out.
They did, big time. Like if we wanted to go to France and work in the morning or go to Spain or if we wanted to have an education and another.
And what I can't understand, I was watching there's a documentary on Netflix on the evacuation of Dunkirk. It's a series of on World War II in colour. And as academics and so on are inputting into the documentary, and it was an extraordinary rescue. And they took thousands of French troops with them as well on the evacuation from Dunkirk, which saved the war, like, because it would have been a much different Europe if that evacuation didn't, and they had a lot of luck and all of that. But it kind of showed how bound up Europe, like, it's extraordinary that having had those common experiences, that would happen. That so we need to be careful. I think we're a very pro-European Union country, and people are entitled to their views on it and so on, but we always need to kind of understand that it has been a positive influence, I think, from environmental issues, but above all from just broadening our minds, you know.
But even in infrastructure that we have as well, you know.
Yeah, like, early on, the cohesion funds and all that. But we're seeing, like, as when during the COVID, actually, the early parts, you know, people were talking about banning travel and all this kind of stuff. You actually realize when we're trying to do that kind of stuff, we're a seamless part of Europe now. There's lots of Irish people working in Germany and France and in the Netherlands, you know, Belgium and so on like that.
And Cork is now the second biggest English-speaking Europe in the EU, or a city. Cork is the second biggest English-speaking after Dublin.
Oh. We're going to get an awful slagging. there they go again, the Cork.
Stay in your
lane. We're always at a number one or number two.
But you know what? Cork is a great place, isn't it?
I love
Cork. You know, our iconography from Knocknaheeny, Shandon is on the wall, Christy Ring is on the wall, the Taoiseach is in the house.
And in 10 years, Cork will look completely different.
It's going to be fabulous.
Marina, where we are now, some development.
It's interesting, a friend of mine, one of my brothers, came down during Christmas or before Christmas. There was a concert with his wife, and he said, "This place is hopping." He said, "It's a beautiful city." Yeah. And compared to Dublin, he said, or Belfast, he said, "I can't get over it." And people do like visiting the city. I love this inner city streets. I spoke earlier about Dunbar Street and them. And I used to work in a chemist when I was 12. When I was 14, 15. I worked in Bennett's and North Main Street when I was packing shells when I was a 12-year-old. And so we used to walk home, like, or get to number three, but normally I'd walk. Like,
the luxury for the south side was to be able to walk with no hills.
No hills, you see, that's exactly it. Yeah, we had some hills south. Have you ever walked Nicholas Hill, have you?
I know I have, but it's not the same.
I was running from a gang there, wasn't it?
It's not the same.
And I said, I get up Nicholas Hill, they won't catch me.
No, it's not the same when you go to the man and you live in Knocknaheeny.
It's a great city. Because it's so small, it's, and in the middle.
It's familiar, like it's...
Everywhere is 5 minutes away from...
That's the beauty of it. That is the beauty of it, yeah.
Anywhere, you know?
That's what I love about it. Yeah. And
Cork people in general are just nice
and
people.
And then you're...
Get on that, to we all agree with that,
like. But then you're close to places like East Cork and West Cork, where we have a charmed existence if we only know it. Like, you know, down to the sea, you can get to the Crossover very quickly. You can get to Fountainstown, get to Yall, you know.
The history, there's fairy forts and castles everywhere. That's right, but we won't keep you much longer. Thanks a million for coming on the podcast. It was a real honour to talk to you.
Thank you both very much indeed. It's an honour for me to be here.
No bother, and Happy New Year to you and your family. And thanks very much. Best of luck with everything.
Thanks indeed.
And thanks to Mary for helping.
Mary Rose.
Mary Rose.
Thanks, Mary Rose. Not Mary, the wife.
Well, everyone knows Mary Rose from the office.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. See you later, lads.
Thanks.
God bless.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.